Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, continuing our conversations about the cultures of consciousness. It was about 12 years ago when I was in India, in Goa, India, where I had been sent on a juicy ticket provided by Details Magazine to write about psychedelic music in Goa, which was quite a trip, but another story. And decided to take a little cruise around the middle part of India with my wife. And so we wound up in Bangalore in the state of Karnataka. And just outside of Bangalore, there was a Tibetan, or is Tibetan, a monastery called Sera May. And I had read, I believe, in the Co-Evolution Quarterly or some similar rag that someone there was doing a interesting project of transcribing Tibetan, the classical collections of Tibetan Buddhist texts from the ancient scrolls to computer disks. And this was called the Asian Classics Input Project. And at that time, I was writing about new technologies. This was before the World Wide, or just as the World Wide Web, as we know it, was coming online. So it was a very interesting time on the edge of our information apocalypse. And so this seemed like a good story. I was a journalist. So we just went to Sera May, no connection, just showed up. Everyone kind of ignored us for a while until this Dutch woman was like, "Can I help you?" And she proceeded to take us to see the fellow who happened to be in town, the Western Lama, who was heading up the project, a guy named Michael Roach. And at that time, Michael Roach seemed like a pretty straight-ahead Gelugpa monk. He was in the robes. It was clear he was kind of a true believer, but also a sparkly-eyed, interesting character. We talked about science fiction, about William Gibson. We talked about mescaline. I was interested and continue to be interested in the connection between psychedelics and the Western Dharma. And so we had a very interesting conversation, and he gave me a copy of a book by Tsongkhapa, which I proceeded to read, and which kind of blew my mind, partly because of the situation, partly because of the time in my life. And when I got back to New York, where I was living at the time, I decided to study with Mr. Roach, and I did so for about, I'd say about less than a year, maybe six to 9 months. So he was a very warm-hearted teacher. The scene was pretty intellectual. We studied texts. We talked about philosophy. I found the structure ultimately a little confining in terms of the way that the philosophical ideas were being laid out and the programmatic nature of the meditations, where you were supposed to proceed through and meditate on all these various points and ideas and images, etc. And it was all a bit busy for me, so I found my way to Zen, which was a quite different a kettle of fish and, again, a different story. So I became kind of friendly with Michael Roach, and I interviewed him for an article I wrote about the Asian Classics Input Project. And the oddest thing we did is that dressed in civilian clothes, he took me down to the diamond warehouse where which was part of his business. He had been working in diamonds, and I think for quite a long time, made quite a lot of money, which is not a factor in his story. But he also had this curious kind of metaphysical reading of the diamond, because of course the diamond is a very important symbol inside of Tibetan Buddhism, and often represents this notion of emptiness, the essential lack of essence in all things. And so it was a very peculiar experience to go into a diamond warehouse with this sort of curious, roly-poly, friendly monk and look at, millions of dollars worth of diamonds sitting on a desk. So that was a bit odd, but not half as odd as the next turn in Michael Roach's life, where he really became a renegade, a sort of an heterodox figure, barely on the edges of accepted Tibetan Buddhism, gets reprimanded by the Dalai Lama, grows his hair long, begins to talk about Tantra, seems to have a girlfriend. It all gets very weird, and this is all after my experience with him, although I could see seeds of this more heterodox, wild character in what I perceived at the time to be a very straight-ahead and clearly very celibate, twinkly-eyed monk. But these stories are all second to the great tale that lies at hand and will be our subject this hour as we talk with investigative journalist Scott Carney, which is the tragic death that occurred at Michael Roach's compound in Diamond Mountain in Arizona a number of years ago. But rather than rehearse that story, I think I'd like to bring on our guest today, Scott Carney. Hey, Scott, how are you doing?
Good. How are you?
Very good. Very good. I was just I had a nice morning reading through some of the commentary and reviews of your book, because with a book like this where you're talking about spiritual matters of such a kind of intriguing character, it's going to stir up a lot of responses. So it was very interesting to read within the Buddhist press, within the secular press, how people were responding to the book, because of course it stirs up all sorts of fears and fascinations that people have with spiritual practice and Tibetan, you know, practice, especially today. So it was quite fun. But for those of our listeners who don't know the tale, I'm just going to sort of hand it over to you. I'm sure you've told it many, 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 many times at this point. But I would be interested in hearing how you first heard about the incidents at Diamond Mountain and what roughly happened. And then we can go from there in terms of trying to figure out how to extract some meaning from these bizarre occurrences.
Sure. Well, I was working on a story for Details magazine about instances of Westerners going to India on spiritual quests and then disappearing, either because they literally just disappeared off the map. No one could find them. They left their belongings behind and vanished. Or they ended up dead after either a suicide or a murder and those sorts of things. And I came to find references in the clinical literature about something called India syndrome, which is where when going to India or also other holy places like Jerusalem or Rome, where people get overcome with the notions of holiness and lose their minds, often think that they're either Jesus in Jerusalem or in India they might think they're an incarnation of Shiva or a Buddha, and the symptoms sort of match closely to schizophrenia. And I was really fascinated with this, and I'd just finished my story, and then I got this email from a member of a Tibetan Buddhist community in Arizona called Diamond Mountain. And one of the members of the community told me that Ian Thorson, who was this 38-year-old, whip-smart Stanford graduate, had entered into a 3-year silent meditation retreat in the deserts of Arizona under the guidance of a Tibetan Buddhist guru, and he died on the silent meditation retreat after fleeing into the mountains with his wife. And I saw that there were these parallels, really interested in the connections between spiritual quests and madness for a long time. And within a month, I was in a car traveling from where I lived at the time in Long Beach, California, to Arizona to see how the community was dealing with these deaths and who else maybe was on that path. Did you want to know more about the
story? I'm asking what was the first your first impression of the community?
Okay, well, when I arrived at a teaching called the Lam Rim teaching, which is in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, something called the Steps on the Path to Enlightenment. And Michael Roach, who's this sort of controversial Tibetan Lama, was giving the teaching, and you know, at this point, the press was starting to get really interested in the case, because when Ian died, you know, a 3-year silent meditation retreat is a very intensive thing that you might undergo. You know, you're going to be totally silent for 3 years doing spiritual, you know, practices and not really, you know, communicating with the outside world. And then there are these stories that started to emerge that 3 months before they had gone, that this had happened, Ian had been stabbed by his wife, a woman named Lama Christy McNally. And there were all sorts of warnings that were coming out of the community. And, you know, when I arrived, there was this question, was how would the community of true believers interpret what happened to Ian? And, you know, some people, you know, disavowed him, said that he had made sort of a spiritual mistake. But other people were saying, you know, he died on his spiritual quest. Maybe he had found some ultimate truth. Maybe he had become a god after doing these practices. And that is sort of a scary thing to hear, right? If you hear about, you know, people making references to people whose pretty grim and dramatic death could actually be viewed in this very holy light.
Well, yeah, I mean, isn't that, in a way, that's part of the whole story of the embrace of Tantra in the West, is that, you know, it's of course an extremely complicated topic, but Tantra does have some associations, even in both its Buddhist and Hindu origin sites, with transgression. And what it seems to happen is that when this model gets translated into the West, there, a different kind of ideas about transgression emerge. So suddenly you get this sort of space where all sorts of bizarre, immoral, illegal kinds of behaviors can be, if not exactly supported, at least they have some sort of room. It's almost as if the collective story that the group is telling allows for these shifts that in most conventional situations everyone would be really clear that there's either psychopathology or something explicitly illegal, and yet it's almost like the reality story has shifted enough that people lose those conventional ways of talking about things. Sure. And was, as you learned more about what had happened with Ian, did you become was it more like, did it get weirder and weirder in terms of the kinds of assumptions that people were working on, in terms of the kinds of worldviews that people were living within? Or did it seem like a fairly circumscribed, let's call it an aberration, of a bunch of people who were attempting to do spiritual work in a reasonably focused way?
Well, you know, Tibetan Buddhism and also Hinduism have two separate paths, right? There's the tantric path and there's the sutra path. And the sutra path, which is these are open teachings that they teach to anyone, which is like, you know, how to live well in the world, how to do no harm, you know, and they're basically ethical teachings for how to interact with the community. And according to the words of the Buddha, if you follow the sutra path, you will get to enlightenment, but it might take you 10,000 lifetimes to get there. And then there's the tantric path. And the tantric path is, instead of being part of a community, it's looking inside and having these very powerful experiences through meditation and sort of controversial practices. And the way it's taught is that from the Buddha and from in Hinduism, is that if you go the tantra path, you risk going into madness, but you also might achieve transcendence in a single lifetime, which, you know, so one's speedy to enlightenment, one's really, really slow. And I think that in America, we have this feeling that we, you know, if we're going to go on a spiritual path, we want to go, you know, go into it like we're competing into a sporting event. We want to get enlightened right now, no matter what, because, hey, enlightenment sounds really great. And one of the assumptions in Hinduism and Buddhism and many faiths, actually, even Christianity to some degree, is that there are two worlds, right? We have the world that we can see, which is the ordinary mundane world where we deal with, you know, our taxes and the untimely death of our pets and all sorts of things that don't seem to have explanations that are you know, necessarily sensical or meaningful in sort of a deeper sense. And then there's this idea that you're seeing an illusory world, that the real world we live in does not conform to the true nature of reality and the universe. You know, what Christians might call God's will, or Buddhists might see as the hidden actions of karma. This internal clockwork of the universe. And the tantric path says that we're going to go find out that internal clockwork of the universe, and the real world that you live in is fake in a way. And if you imbibe that idea and you take it down to its logical path, and you have this guru saying, "Hey, I know reality, and everything that you think is actually wrong. It's not the real reason why we're here." You can head down a path of what looks like insanity from the rest of the world. But as a practitioner, you might think that you're being perfectly reasonable. And I find this a very dangerous tendency in all religions. But I think it's particularly dangerous among Westerners who then adopt a foreign religion that they don't understand the cultural context for. Like, if you were a Tibetan and you grew up in a Tibetan community, and you saw this mad yogi who's doing things that are clearly, you know, crazy and perhaps harmful to the community, you might be able to contextualize that in a better way, just in the same way that you might be able to view, you know, if I was in New York and I grew up in New York and I saw a guy dressed in robes walking around saying he was Jesus and you know, kill all the gays, you might be like, well, that's contextually maybe a little wrong. But because we're misreading these cultural cues, you can get taken down a very dangerous path if you accept these lessons uncritically.
Right. No, that makes a lot of sense. But on the one of the things that interests me about your approach is that on the one hand, you are raising these issues, these concerns. You're looking at psychological issues. You're looking at examples of people who have gone too far. You're shedding some light, not just in the case of Thorsen, which is kind of an extreme case, but you're shedding light on some of the dark sides of meditation practice or right. of Westerners adopting these views. But on the other hand, you didn't go as far as other investigative journalists would, who were purely secular, cynical, would walk in here and go, this was a cult, Michael Roach was, you know, psychologically manipulating these people, he's just, you know, and just a very, in a way, using a very well-established Western template for understanding mm-hmm. alternative religions. But you didn't do that either. You're sort of moving in a place in between. You wanted to take their search seriously and to recognize that, you right. know, the legitimacy of these things. How then, you know, and you can talk about your own experience. I know that there was a motivating experience in your own life in terms of seeing this dark side. But I'm curious, in your own life, your own experience with meditation and with Buddhism, how that sort of helped you in a way try to find a middle path between, you know, embracing these counterfactual phantasms that lurk in so many religious paths, but also not, you know, hewing to a straight and narrow secular reductionist sure. view.
Yeah, I mean, many of my reviews say, why didn't I just call Diamond Mountain a cult? Because once you can identify something as a cult, you can be like, well, they were crazy, and you can just walk away and say they did nothing meaningful, or their journey was just ridiculous, and we sort of write off cults off. But one of the things I wanted to get to in the book is that even if it was a cult, right? Even if it was one of these things that's abusive and manipulative and has a crazy ideology, every spiritual quest has an element of that in it, and anyone can be pulled in one of these directions if you just take the logic a little further down than sort of the vast majority of the community. I mean, if you look at the creation story of Christianity, right? You know, Jesus was, you know, was able to perform these miracles. You know, turns water into wine, and you know, he duplicates fish. He gets crucified on a cross, and then actually raises from the dead. That is from a totally rational perspective, ridiculous. It could never have happened. These are miracles. These are crazy things. Yet people take that as an article of faith, and you know.
Yeah, not to mention the cannibalism of the Eucharist. It is pretty bizarre stuff. You know, it's funny. I mean, what this raises for me when I think about these issues is that let's not use the word cult because that's later, but let's call them sects. You know, even though that's not quite right, but you know, like a small group of spiritual practitioners who are totally going for it, really intense. Maybe there's a charismatic leader. They begin to remap reality. They're starting to abandon a lot of conventional notions, and they're moving into this zone. Part of the way I look at those things is they're like risky social experiments, and they have a certain kind of risk associated with them, and sometimes they'll go south and people will get hurt, people will even die. They can go really south and there's whole really creepy, you know, child abuse and stuff like that. But a lot of times they're just kind of weird for a while, and then people leave or don't, they find their way out. And I, as someone who kind of was fascinated by these things, who has my own spiritual stories, my own searches, my own interests, my own fascination with this side of human culture, you know, this doesn't look, you know, any worse to me than any number of other things that people do for entertainment, for exploration, that also have certain risks involved with them.
Well, before Manson, the word cult wasn't a bad word, right? Before the sort of mass killings, Jonestown and David Koresh, cult was a word to describe sort of an eccentric spiritual group, you know, sort of oddball religions on the fringes that maybe weren't so dangerous. And, you know, I sort of have a formula for how I think about the difference between a cult and a religion, which is cult plus religion – sorry, cult – plus time equals religion. There's no, look at Mormonism. 100 years ago, they were the craziest religion out there. And now we have, you know, last presidential election, we had a Mormon running for president. So there's a thing where we incorporate sort of fringe ideas, and society and the culture around sort of adopts these ideas and makes them acceptable. But when you're someone new, yeah, you're dangerous, as you said. You know, you don't know which way it will go. Maybe it goes down to pedophilia and mass murder, or maybe it just goes to some people to practicing some weird, you know, crystal worship, sort of oddball beliefs that don't hurt anyone. Yeah. And personally, I feel like you can get spiritual growth out of many different religions, you know, and many different types of belief systems. I'm of sort of a pretty typical American belief system, which is that there's no one single truth that's out there, but there's multiple truths, and any path that someone takes has the potential to give you wonderful results, but it also has the potential to hurt you. And I think it's really important with any spiritual quest to ride that ambiguous line between this is a horrible, pejorative, bad thing and this is a wonderful thing. Like, you know, the world is about gray areas, and the spiritual self is not about having hard and fast answers to anything. And I can't say for sure with beyond any shadow of the doubt that the guru in my book, Michael Roach, didn't know what, you know, the divine nature of humanity really was. You know, I don't have that knowledge. I don't claim to have that knowledge. He does. I can't objectively say that he never he doesn't have that. I don't think he does, but by the way the group has sort of, you know, played out. But maybe knowing ultimate truth is not necessarily the goal either. Like, maybe the goal in my mind is just to be able to live with ambiguity and get the most out of it.
Yeah, that's a good way of characterizing the position, and it comes through in the way you frame the story as well. But I did want to talk a little bit more about Michael Roach, because, you know, in some ways he's not, even at the worst elements, it's not a cult situation in terms of he's not a total authoritarian, he's not controlling people's access to their families, he's, you know, the people who choose to go on a 3-year retreat, which is a traditional form, are, you know, the advanced students, he's not just insisting everybody, you know, cut off all ties, et cetera, et cetera. And yet there's this weird enigmatic quality to him that
Hello? Do we lose you? Hello?
This, you know, smiley, twinkly-eyed monk, and, you know, we studied in a very traditional fashion that was kind of dry and not at all charismatic. And so I had this very interesting impression of him from a long time ago, And I know that you weren't really able to deal with him directly. You know, you had one little kind of short conversation with him. But what is your overall impression of, you know, what was motivating the guy? What happened? How did he go from being a straight up monk to this kind of tantric outlier?
And Roach is a true believer, you know, and he didn't start off as a Buddhist. He started off as an Episcopalian. He was a highest level Boy Scout Order of the Arrow. He was a seeker from the very beginning. And I think when he went to India to meet the Dalai Lama and to study with some various groups there, he hoped to find answers to life's ambiguous questions. His brother had committed suicide right before he went to India. His mother died around the same time. And he was looking for those answers. And then he finds – and one of the things that's really interesting about Tibetan Buddhism is that – instead of just praying, right, and having these things that we do in sort of a Christian and a Judeo-Christian tradition, meditation and yoga and these other practices prepare you to have certain physical experiences. When you sit and you meditate, you know, even the most basic practitioners will feel things like time speeding up and slowing down. They'll see colors, you know, when they close their eyes, different things will flip between their eyelids. And you can actually feel yourself changing as you're doing that. Now, advanced practitioners and many teachers will tell you that those symptoms of meditation might be meaningless. They might not do anything. But it's very what would you say? It's very alluring to have those experiences and think that maybe you're a little special. And very early on in Michael Roach's career, after he'd sort of decided to take a teacher in New Jersey at the Dalai Lama's suggestion, he had an experience preparing tea where he slipped into this, let's call it a hallucination or vision or something like this, where he's standing above the world and he's loving all the world and he feels this incredible connection to an inner truth. And I think that vision is what guided him to do all the things he did down the line. And it's interesting that when you have a vision and your vision is your guiding source and not texts and not sort of the wisdom of a teacher, you can really come up with any philosophy you want that appeases your own experiences. And he became unreliable in a lot of ways. I mean, he was at once a very good scholar, he helped preserve Tibetan texts, but he never very seriously listened to the advice of the rest of the Tibetan community, especially when he married a woman named Lama Christie McNally, who later he divorced, and Lama Christie married Ian. And he would teach these tantric practices that were, he wasn't qualified to by the Tibetan tradition. What Michael Roach did is he would take texts that he found in archives in Russia and in India and China, and he would transcribe them digitally into a computer. And then, you know, some of these texts, they're from all sorts of things. There's medicine texts, tantric texts, sutra texts, histories, everything. He would take these texts and then read, say, a tantric passage and say, oh, well, now I understand how this tantra works. And without any sort of guidance from outside, begin teaching himself tantra, which is not the way the tantra is usually taught. It's usually taught in the presence of an experienced guru. And you can't just take something from a book unless you are already divine in nature, unless you're already a god. That's the way Tibetans think of it. And he just sort of went off the rails. He made up his own religion as he went. And in doing so, he would – and which is not necessarily bad to make up your own religion, but he taught this religion to his followers in America, saying that this was the ancient teachings of the Buddha and that he knew – there was an uninterrupted lineage between him and all the way back to prehistory. And that was really where he erred, is he kept wearing the robes of a monk in the Tibetan Gelugpa tradition and wasn't – telling the people that he was editorializing pretty seriously along the way.
Yeah, I think that's a really key point. In that, there are some, as you know, as we talked about earlier, there's some forms of these alternative religious experiments that are clearly experimental, and people who are involved in them are like, okay, I'm going to ride with this guy for a while. Let's see what's going to happen with this experiment. But a lot of other stuff comes in the guise of tradition, and with tradition you expect a certain kind of slowness, a certain kind of necessary learning process, a kind of larger hierarchy of authorities that are going to constrain these sort of wild actors. And when you mix those two, then things get really weird. And of course, that's one of the main things that we see with like contemporary, especially Eastern spirituality in the West, is how many things that are very new, or at least amalgamations that are very new, getting presented as ancient practices going back thousands of years. I mean, yoga, hatha yoga, is the sort of most obvious example, since we know historically how much of it was a product of the encounter with the West in the late 19th century, right, et cetera, et cetera. We've talked about that on the show before. But with this case, you have something deeper in a way, because his students were being sort of asked to go on a ride that was, you know, had many, many levels, very powerful, that drew from very intense ideas and practices that do draw from these traditional religious structures, but without those organizations, without those checks and balances. I remember at the time a lot of people were just like, hey, he can do whatever he wants, but just take the robes off, guy. But he didn't take the robes off.
Right. And I think that's the major critique of Roach. And I think it stands is that, you know, anyone's totally legit for making up your own religion. I mean, you're allowed to do that. This is the world, and no one has better direct access to the eternal truth than anyone else. But when you do a tradition, it's sort of like it's like stealing someone else's brand or trademark and then changing it all around to suit your own purposes. And he uses the robes because people in America and in the West will look at someone in robes and be like, oh, you must be serious, right? Oh, you studied in Tibet, therefore you must have better knowledge than these other people. And that's sort of a sham. It's because it's just not true. There's no one in the world who has better access to our divine nature than anyone else. But when he steals and appropriates these foreign symbols, it seems to lend him authority to his followers. I mean, there was this time when he was giving an initiation to Ian Thorson, who's the sort of the main character of my book. And Ian was going to take a vow to become a bodhisattva. And Roach gives his like 2-hour-long speech about what this means and what the vows do. And then he says, now it's time to take your initiation. And I'm going to say the ritual in Tibetan, and I'm going to say this because you'll take it more seriously if it's in a language you don't understand, which is, you know, maybe true. That's, you know, the church did that for a while when they taught services in Latin. But it's also sort of disingenuous, because if you're not understanding what vow you're taking, what exactly are you doing? It's you're exoticizing these faiths for your own ends.
I can't resist an example of this from another zone that I just heard about that's so hilarious, is that in Santo Daime, which is a ayahuasca-using Brazilian syncretic tradition, they sing these very beautiful hymns. It's a fairly Christian vibe. People are wearing white. They're singing hymns. And a lot of, you know, Americans who go down there, you know, talk about the beauty of these hymns, and they're just so transcendent. But apparently there's a large chunk of the regular service, the hymns are just singing the bylaws of the organization. But they're very beautiful, apparently. So I think that's a quite a funny way. Well, anyway, we're going to have to take a break right here, but I got a bunch of other questions for you. We're talking with Scott Carney about Michael Roach and Diamond Mountain and the troubles with meditation. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Expanding Mind with your host, Eric Davis. I'm talking with Scott Carney about his book, A Death on Diamond Mountain. You know, it's funny, Scott, I was just listening to the ad spots here on PRN, and I noticed there's sort of an interesting tension. On the one hand, a lot of the shows here are very critical, political shows. They're, you know, they're looking at the news. They're questioning the dominant accounts from a left progressive point of view. There's a sort of, you know, hermeneutics of suspicion, as we say in scholarship, about reality. And yet at the same time, there's this sort of vein of shows in the progressive space that's also part of progressive culture in America, where there's this sort of sense of spiritual powers, of alternative medicine, of indigenous teachings, of Asian teachings. And with that zone, there's often a noticeable lack of kind of critical commentary. There's sort of almost it's almost like there's a space for a certain kind of belief that is otherwise really questioned in terms of the view of mainstream society. And it's a very strange kind of bipolar situation that I think a lot of us find ourselves in, and that your mm-hmm. book is kind of about navigating, you know, navigating that kind of space. I'm curious whether, you know, over the years since you've been interested personally in meditation and spiritual practices, whether you have become more or less, let's say, skeptical or critical of the forms that these searches take in contemporary America over the time?
Well, that's a very difficult question. And it's mostly because I live in this sort of ambiguous space where I pretty much always tell myself that I don't know what the true answers are. And I have found personally some very eye-opening experiences from meditative practices. I lived in India for 6 years, traveled through Tibet, traveled through, you know, Nepal and Southeast Asia, and speak some of the languages, and I've seen some things which are truly mystifying and I can never truly explain. I've also had experiences where while meditating, and actually the next book that I'm working on is about a type of meditation based off of the Tibetan tradition of Tummo, where you can consciously raise and lower your body temperature and do some sort of things that are pretty miraculous with it. You know, at one point I ended up sitting on the banks of a river in Poland, melting all the snow around me with my body heat, something that, you know, a guy from California never thought I would ever want to do. So there's this side of me that's like, wow, there's something really powerful, really great here. And yet on the other side, I also see people who go down these paths and who put an incredible amount of faith in powers or hidden wisdoms of various sorts of sizes. And I can see how you become a very unreliable person if you pursue that, to the disregard of other things. You know, people who might follow an ayahuasca vision, you know, to reform their whole life might drop out of society. They might, you know, lose their jobs. They might end up being mendicants, travelers, or you know, in the case of Ian Thorson, you might end up meditating until you die in the deserts of Arizona. And there's lots of people I know who have gone down that path. And I don't have a resolution for this, because if on one hand there is a true ultimate reality, then maybe it doesn't matter if you're, you know, selling flowers by the side of the road for your life. You know, there's the story of the Buddha, how the Buddha appeared as a lame and crippled dog, and yet he was also this enlightened lame and crippled dog. I don't have final ultimate answer to that. In terms of how the progressive community deals with it, I think the progressive community is incredibly diverse. And, you know, just like the conservative side spectrum of America, they embrace all sorts of different positions. And we've just sort of lumped ourselves into these two super huge heterogeneous groups that honestly probably wouldn't – not every part of it's going to get along with each other.
No, that's certainly the case. I know that you spent some time in the book looking at some of the psychological science and studies about the kinds of problems that people get into who are pursuing meditation. You talked earlier about the sort of India syndrome, which you also see in Jerusalem or Rome, where it's clearly the case that some people go there. There's no reason for them to have a radical change in their personality, and yet they become sort of these religious characters. And it's a fascinating thing because, you know, from the secular point of view, you go, oh, wow, they're just sort of – it's sort of this strange kind of – geographical craziness, and then from the spiritual point of view, well, of course, they go to these holy places with all of these enchantments and spirits and gods, and they have a transformation. They convert, and you know, we recognize that conversion is something that people are allowed to do. You know, if you become a born again Christian, you know, your friends might think it's a bummer, but they're not going to say, well, you've gone completely insane, or they might say that, but the society doesn't recognize that. So, alongside these kind of changes, this India syndrome, Jerusalem syndrome, what are some of the other things that you found that, you know, might just be helpful for more people to know as they themselves navigate this ambiguous path that we're talking about?
Well, you know, one of the things that was really interesting coming up in my research is that there's Western clinical literature that diagnoses mental problems that might happen arising from meditation. But there's also an incredible tradition of literature in the Tibetan and the Hindu and the yogic traditions that talk about the same sorts of symptoms. People, you know, in yoga, there's something called Kundalini syndrome, where you know, the spiritual explanation is you've awakened your Kundalini energy. It's burst through your head, and you've sort of gone crazy, you know, and you get so open to all the energies in the world that you can no longer, you know, basically, you know, keep your shit together, for you know, lack of a better way to say it. And you know, the symptoms match up very well to sort of schizophrenia induced by meditation and yoga. You'll also see in the Tibetan tradition something called lung. Lung means wind in Tibetan. And when someone who is a very intensive meditator, usually people who are focused on a particular goal like transcendence or enlightenment, may become overcome with anxiety and feel depersonalized and forget who they are as a person. And it's known to happen in the Tibetan tradition. And the only cure, they say, is basically stop meditating. Like, you meditated too much. You got to quit for a little while, and then maybe you can get back to it later. In the Western tradition, it comes up, and they say it's very similar to anxiety or even post-traumatic stress syndrome. And it's really cool to see how these two traditions are basically talking about the same conditions, that somebody who just got too into their own path and it has manifested as you know, sort of antisocial, no longer getting along with society behavior. And that was, you know, that was quite fascinating. And, you know, one of the things that I think I want to mention as well is that meditation, you know, it can be dangerous. And the reason I got onto this book in the very first place is that in 2006, I was leading an abroad program in northern India. And I just dropped out of a PhD program in anthropology, and I was trying to, you know, figure out what I wanted to do with my life. And I took this job, and I had about a dozen students under my care, and I took them to the various holy sites in North India. We started in Delhi, went to Varanasi, which is where it's the holy city of the dead, and then we ended up in Bodh Gaya, which is where the Buddha attained enlightenment, you know, a little more than two millennia ago. And this was the highlight of the trip, where we would do a 10-day silent meditation retreat under the guidance of a Swiss-German nun who spoke perfect English and would be teaching us the basic tenets of Tibetan Buddhism. It was silent, so we weren't talking, and I was sitting among my students, you know, just like them, sort of a novice at these ideas. And one of my students, she was the best and the brightest in the group. Her name was Emily O'Connor, and she was had studied yoga and meditation in the States, and this was for her the highlight of the trip. And she was always sitting in front of me in perfect lotus pose, really just enjoying it. And at the end of the retreat, on the last day of it, I asked her, you know, what did you think? And she said this was a totally blissful experience. It was possibly the most life-changing thing of my that I've ever done, which seems like, you know, as the teacher of her program, that sounded like, you know, great, good experience for this student. But then that night, you know, the students are then talking again. You know, they stay up in the temple at night, and they're talking to 3 a.m. I've gone to bed. And then she climbs up onto the roof of the retreat center, and she's writing in her journal. She says, the key to, the next level to transcendence is understanding my own death. Then she writes, I am a bodhisattva. And bodhisattva means someone who's on the cusp of enlightenment in this case. And then she jumped off the roof of the retreat center to her death died on impact. And so for the next 3 days, I was, you know, busy bringing her, you know, body back to the United States. And I'm trying to reconcile how someone who is not depressed, but actually completely blissful and says they've had this transformative experience can get to a point where they're like, well, I no longer need my body because I've achieved this perfect state. And then she, you know, takes her own life. And that in many ways is the reason why I even got onto this book in the first place, is that I wanted to understand the madness that is inherent in many spiritual journeys. And any of us could potentially be susceptible to that.
No, it's all very, very true words. I mean, the only thing I have to add to that, you know, terrible story is just my own experience of doing, you know, week-long retreats. And one time I had I'll just call it a break. And I knew there was enough of my awareness to know that something was wrong. But otherwise, I was inside of a very powerful, you know, dark paranoid scenario in which these beings were, you know, eating soul. It was just, you know, it was like crazy stuff, like a dream. And I had just enough awareness to know that something was wrong and that the best thing to do was to stop meditating. So I'm sitting there in this silent hall, you know, 5 days into this like powerful, focused group ritual of silent meditation. You know, it's into the night. And then I'm sitting there like singing show tunes in my head and like moving my eyeballs around because I'm like, I got to get out of here. And, you know, it went away or whatever. And it was just, you know, and I'm psychologically stable. I haven't had breaks, da 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 da. But it was really instructive. And it was also very instructive to see the way in which the onset of that experience had both a kind of narrative fantastic quality, like, oh yeah, I'm learning more, I'm opening up into another dimension, or whatever the kind of inside the meditator's head is. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, there were very clear signs that I could see later of, oh, actually, here I'm entering into a kind of trance, and it's like I'm no longer able to reflect, and there's da da da. And mm-hmm. It's a very strange process. It's like it's the same ambiguity we're talking about throughout the whole show, where there's an inside and there's an outside, and they're both, you know, they're both kind of true in a way. And then mm-hmm. the question is, why do some people, or what are the circumstances that lead people to go totally one, or in some sense, totally the other? Because you also, even though you've seen these negative things, and you've had firsthand experience of how dangerous this stuff can be, you're still, you know, interested and open to it. So there is this kind of middle, again, a kind of middle path between the inside and the out.
Hey, you're making me sound like the Buddha. I love it. I'm just there.
Well, it's just probably it's something that it's part of my work for my whole life has been trying to, like, you know, find this line, or not find it, but constantly kind of recreate it. And on that tip, I wanted to ask you a specific question also about, in your book, you talk about an experience where you're at a writer's retreat working on this project, and you have a series of disturbing, dark, somewhat, you know, enigmatic, maybe even some reviewers call them superstitious kinds of experiences of a kind of dark energy. At the same time, people are warning you that doing the kind of work you're going to do, you might be incurring some negative darts coming your way. You know, there's this sort of shadow side of Tantra, just as there is of ayahuasca religion. And then, so you had your experience, you went out of your way to like, to engage people to give blessings and prayers, protection prayers flowing your way. Now, some investigative journalists writing the kind of book you were doing, knowing that you were going to get some good attention, would, even if they had that experience, not include it. And they would not include it because they didn't want to deal with it. And then it makes you seem soft, or people are like, well, can I really trust this guy because he's thinking this way from a secular perspective? But you chose not to do that. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious about that. How did you feel? Why did that story, which if I've mangled, please clarify, but why did that story need to be part of your story to the world?
Well, it was because I wanted people to embrace this idea of ambiguity in the first place, because you know that's the epilogue to the book, and this whole time I've basically been telling my readers, you know, the really crazy thing that this group has done. And it's very easy to look at Ian Thorson's life and be like, how could this guy, you know, why are we interested in this guy? Because he's obviously doing things that are not rational and, you know, and he's almost a joke. I mean, that's how some people react to him. But I wanted to show that anyone given the sufficient background and environment, that's the better word, can start to have these ideas. And, you know, I'm a very rational guy in general. I have some flights of fancy, but nothing really out of the ordinary. But at this point, I'd been immersed in reading, you know, Michael Roach's words, listening to his lectures, and I'm transcribing the journal that my student wrote before she died, before she took her own life. And it's a pretty dark place. And then I get these messages from people in that community and around that community saying that I've been cursed because I'm a threat to the community. And they're all talking about miracles and all sorts of sort of siddhis and these magical powers that people can accumulate. And, you know, I started getting paranoid. I started feeling like, well, you know, I don't know the ultimate truth of these things, you know, and people are telling me they're walking through walls. And I also know from my background as an anthropologist, curses are real. Like if you curse somebody and you really believe it, that person could very well have a string of terrible luck. Now, it may be because there's a hidden weave of karma and, you know, the clockwork of the universe somehow working there, or it could just be because you're psychologically, you feel like you might be cursed and therefore you do things that are stupid. And in a way, it's irrelevant what that true answer is. It's what that person experiences. Now, I saw some weird shapes. I had a string of particularly terrible luck at that time. You know, my bank accounts were getting hacked. My marriage was falling apart. You know, a whole bunch of money issues were just showing up seemingly out of nowhere. At the same time, I'd been cursed. And as soon as I had this protection prayer, all of those problems seemed to go away. And I could connect those dots in my mind, say, hey, maybe they're all connected. At the same time, I could say that it's probably just crazy to think that. And I wanted the readers to know that anyone could be here, right? I mean, most readers don't have experiences of being cursed or being stuck in this milieu all the time. And I feel like in order to identify with the characters, you need to know that this is possible.
Yeah, I'm curious, what are some of the responses that you've gotten from the book that are the most interesting to you, whether from people, you know, inside Roach's organization or inside Tibetan Buddhism or people from the outside who maybe now are a little bit more open or realize some of the ambiguities that you're pointing out?
Well, I mean, you know, I get a fair number of crazy emails, and one of them that I got that I remember quite clearly was this person who was going to review my book for some publication, and she'd read it, she loved it, she'd been writing to me actually during the course of my research, just saying how excited she was about it. And she read the book, and then she wrote to me being like, "I can't write about this because I know I'm going to get cursed. I know it's going to happen, and I have to get protection prayers right now." And it was like, "What?" You know, I think people sometimes get very you know, wrapped up in this. You know, some people have called me, you know, like I think Salon said I was drunk on this idea of spiritual rapture. While other people are saying, well, look, this is, you know, we're impressed with the idea that I was able to show this potentially weak side, right? That. You know, that I could get wrapped up in this. And in some ways, you know, my feeling is that makes me a more reliable narrator, because instead of hiding and pretending that I'm an objective person outside this story completely, I'm going to admit to you that I'm also a participant in it. You know, after all the stuff went down at Diamond Mountain, all these reporters were there and they were affecting and changing the way that the community responded. And I feel like it's my duty to my readers to show that we're all people in this and we're just trying to get along.
That's great. And so you're writing more about – you're going to continue writing about spiritual matters, yoga, meditation, et cetera?
Yep. The next book, which I'm already working on, is about a guru in Holland who's developed a technique to take control of his body's autonomic functions. Modulating his heartbeat, modulating his blood flow, and raising and lowering his core temperature at will. And I'm looking at the ways that these skills could develop and how we could use them to benefit society in a whole bunch of different ways.
Excellent. Well, Scott, good luck with that project, and thanks so much for joining us on Expanding Mind.
Great. Thank you very much for having me.
All right. From Eric Davis to all you out there, keep your minds open.